This episode courtesy of Gretsch Drums and that great Gretsch sound. Visit GretschDrums.com to see the latest gear and sign up for the Gretsch newsletter.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Is drummer right? Is it okay to say drummer?
Pounding his pulsing beat into the hearts of all America.
You motherfuckers are fucking all over this joint.
You do your kind of drumming, and I'll do my kind of drumming.
I have no more time. You don't know what I'm up against.
The only things I care about in this goddamn life are me and my drums and you.
The official explanation was he choked on vomit.
You suppose maybe I could put the drums in your place and sort of drop in once in a while?
Now back to Gene Krupa's syncopated style shortly.
Get up there behind those drums, lean back, close your eyes, get right on the groove there, give it a good steady beat.
I got blisters on my fingers!
I'd hit that.
I'm in Austin, Texas, with Danny B. Harvey.
How you doing, man?
Danny, I'm glad you could do this today.
I appreciate
it, man.
Glad, too. Glad it worked out. We're in a cool little bar here, honky-tonk.
Yeah, we're at the Sagebrush.
We're not in a studio.
No, we don't do that. We're in the back of the Sagebrush.
Right.
At a table. And a little chilly, but...
Yeah, it's a little chilly, but we're sitting by a big barbecue pit there.
Yeah, exactly. Danny, where are you from?
I'm from all over, but I was originally born in Killeen, Texas. And I lived in Copper's Cove when I was until about 5 or 6.
So, did you have that music growing up in the house? Was your dad?
Yeah, my dad had 4 albums, and he worked for Chrysler after the army. He worked for Chrysler. And then my mom divorced him. She married another army man. But he used to have 4 albums, and he played Johnny Cash, Buck Owens, Johnny Horton, and Tennessee Ernie Ford. And he had one day off a week. It was Sundays. And he put all 4 albums on and let them play, then turn them over and play all 4. So that's all I heard. But also always on the radio. There was whenever the car radio was country music and stuff. And then about 10th grade, my mom married my stepfather. Now my stepfather's from Ashland, Kentucky, and he was really into. He told me about Chet Atkins, and he's actually why I play music. It's not from anyone in my family. So my stepfather was from Ashland, Kentucky, and he'd been in vaudeville when he was a kid, and he could play violin, piano, guitar. And he's good at all of them. So he gave me piano lessons and gave me a guitar. And he's had reel-to-reel tapes. And he played Chet Atkins and stuff. And I remember as a kid getting the guitar and trying to listen to Chet Atkins. It's almost like I'd gone back like 40 years in time. Like the way that, you know, they say that like Chet Atkins would listen to Merle Travis on the radio. Or other guitarists would listen to Chet Atkins and try to emulate him on the radio. So I and my dad would play a reel-to-reel tape. And I'd been there trying to play along with the Chet Atkins. Because in the 70s, you heard no Chet Atkins. There's no Chet Atkins playing for anyone, kids like me. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Are you taking lessons or are you mostly self-taught?
I never took lessons. I didn't take lessons till I got to be about 17. And the first teacher I had was Joe Pass.
Because I studied with Joe Pass.
Yeah, because I took an improv class at this College of the Canyons, which is up in Santa Clarita. It just opened, so, and they didn't have a lot of students there, and the teacher was this guy Bob Downs, and so there's enough students, so he invited all his friends from jazz people. See, Joe Pass came to some of our improv class. I was 16. I was taking this night class in improvisation, and Joe Pass would sit in occasionally, and we'd go every soul. So, and every time he came down, I go, man, I learned so much from, because he'd give me advice while we're playing. He said, I learned so much from you. And he said, well, here's my number. I live in Reseda. If I'm in town, give me a call. And you want some lessons, come on down. So I got to go down to his house maybe over a year, maybe a dozen times. And it was great. I mean, that was the time when Virtuoso was out, and Joe Pass was like the top jazz guitarist in the world.
How old was he at that point?
I was 17, so I would think he was ancient, but he's probably only in his 40s. Right. I don't know any idea, but to me, he was an old man. But I remember I go down to his house, and I learned a lot afterwards. Like that, he had a problem with drugs. He'd gone to prison, but that time he was obviously sober. So every time his house, his wife would make us iced tea, and we'd listen to records. He'd play records, and he always come, and he'd go, don't listen to guitars, listen to piano player, how he's playing their chords, and then we'd pick up guitars, and he'd always show me something amazing that would take me 2 or 3 weeks to digest, and I'd call him, and And that's before, I think it was before answering machines, so he'd have to be there to answer it.
Yeah.
And so if he was there, he'd go, "Oh, yeah, why don't you come down on Wednesday at noon?" And I'd drive down from Canyon Country to his house. So, yes, I got to take lessons from him. And I taught myself how to read. And then I wanted to go to USC to study guitar because Lee Ritenour went there. And at that time, I got into Larry Carlton, Lee Ritenour, and all these like jazz fusion guys. So I had, but to get into USC, I had to play classical. So I learned to play classical. I taught myself some basic classical stuff. And then Pepe Romero was the head of the guitar school. So I went there wanting to study jazz, but I learned so much studying under Pepe Romero. Like, I only went there for a year and a half, and I dropped out and went and joined a rock boy band in London, but that's another story.
Well, what is that quick story? How did that even happen?
What happened, because during that time, I also started hanging. I was also playing, like, I started playing at the Palomino when I was, like, 17, 18, about that same, because I was really good. I did sessions back then, and but I was learning classical, and I was going to school because I wanted to be like Lee right now. And this guy, Duke Miller, taught a program called Functional Guitar, which was pretty much based on how to be a studio guitarist. Like, you know, how to be able to play. Being a studio guitarist, you had to play classical, you had to play jazz, you had to play. But during that time, during playing the Palomino, which I played like three or four nights a week with different country artists, and I also played in house band briefly, I met Levi and the Rockettes when they came up. They were like my age, and they were rock really guys with bleached hair, and we had, one of them had, Levi had blue hair and stuff. So like, and they were really big in Hollywood, and they met me, and then they asked me to, Levi, he left the Rockettes and asked me to start a band with him in London. So I moved to London, and then his old band, the Rockettes.
You just went. You just picked up.
Yeah, I went. We went. We started the band. We went over there. It was fun. I mean, the first lineup of the band had Brian Setzer was the other guitarist, and his brother Gary Setzer, because they had a band called Bloodless Pharaohs. This is like January, February of 1980.
But is this with Setzer in London, or is this?
No, Setzer hadn't gone to London.
That's what I mean. Where is this then?
Him and his brother had a band called Bloodless Pharaohs, and they were in New York, but they had another band called the Tomcats, which is a rockabilly side project he did. So Lee Childers, the manager for Levi, knew they had met them, so they flew him out to L.A. and we rehearsed, and the idea was we were all going to go to London. Now, obviously, Brian is a good, he's a good singer, probably better than Levi, so when he went back to New York and came time to actually go to London, he opted out of the band. So he called and said, "No, me and my brother are going to stay here and do Bloodless Pharaohs." But instead of that, he actually took the Tomcats, and they went to London, and they changed the name to Stray Cats, and you know, the rest is history. But I've known Brian for a long time, and we're still friends and stuff.
Right, but that's not when you met Slim Jim.
No, I met Slim Jim about June of 1980. Me and Levi went to London to live. We went to Berlin to play a couple of shows, then we went to London. So I'm walking on Portobello Road, and Brian's there, and Brian goes, "Daddy, man, I'm here with my band." And I go, "The Bloodless Pharaohs?" He goes, "No, I'm here at the Tomcats," because they were still called the Tomcats. And he goes, "Oh, this is my drummer, Slim Jim, and Lee. This is my bass player, Lee." The Slim Jim had a cane, and all I remember thinking is, why is this like 17-year-old kid have a cane? And I found out later, now me and Jim have worked a lot together. But I know the story is the day they arrived in London, he twisted his ankle. And so they were walking around, I'm saying, why is this like teenager have a cane?
Just ahead of his time, right? That became a thing in the hip hop world.
Yeah, so I remember in Brian said, "Hey, we're trying to get some shows and stuff." And I guess it really happened really fast. And they got a good publicist. They had their picture in Enemy with hanging out with Mick Jagger and Keith Richards at the venue. They changed the name. Dave Edmunds took them to the studio. They changed the name to Stray Cats. And band, they hit. And they were great. I mean, they wrote great songs. Brian sang great. But so it was good. So I got this. I saw their first couple shows as well. Like,
nice.
Yeah.
But so you were there. You're in London. You formed this band.
Yeah.
With Levi.
Yeah.
And how long are you there for?
I stayed the whole time I was in there. His old bandmates, the Rockettes, kind of located in New York, and they got signed to Island. And we never really got a record deal, but we got. And so every time we'd see them, because they'd come to play London, and we'd all hang out, or we played a lot in New York, and they'd always be going, "Hey man, quit Levi, come join our band. Quit Levi, join our band." So finally, they're going like, they have a record deal and stuff. So I quit Levi, and I went and joined the Rockettes. So I moved from London to New York. So,
man, And every time you do this, they're saying, "Don't worry, we got a place for you." Are you crashing on couches?
Well, when I first went there, I went to L.A. I lived in L.A. But that's when they called me and said, "You got to come out." So they offered me a plane ticket to fly to New York. So I went there, and who did I stay at then when I went there? Oh, I stayed in the closet of Tony and Jake Riviere. And the Jake Riviere, he started, he had that, what's the band? The Stiff Records. And Jake and his wife was Tony Riviere. So they had this big suite, and Elvis Costello was playing over New Year's, and they had this big suite for like a week there. But the room was so big, it's at the Essex House, that they had, their closet was as big as a room. So they had them put a cot in the closet, and I had a room in their suite. but we played New Year's Eve, the Rockettes, we played the Old Peppermint Lounge, and then after that was all over, then I had to go out. During that time, I went and met my friend, this guy Rick, and I gave him some money to become for deposit, and I became his roommate on January 1st. So.
Do you remember where?
Chelsea, 24th and 8th.
Right by the hotel?
Yep, right. Yeah, it was right around the corner from the hotel, and it was right across from London Terrace was the name of the apartment building that was there, that was built back in the 20s. The year before that, when me and Levi, when we first went to New York with Levi, we spent the whole summer at the Chelsea Hotel. We lived there for 3 months.
So what was that like at that point?
The Chelsea Hotel was a dive place, yeah. And it wasn't cool, and that was like pretty shortly after, like, you know, Stiv had killed Nancy there, or Nancy had died there, and Stiv got accused of it, however you look at it, but so it was a pretty bad hotel, and we had an air conditioner that dripped. And it's four of us in one room. We had a cot and two double beds, and we take turn who got the single bed. And it had like a little kitchenette. But the whole summer we stayed there, since we slept all day, they never cleaned it. But the air conditioner dripping, the whole floor had become a swamp. So every time we sit on the carpet, it'd be squish, squish, squish. and we told them about it, but they never fixed it. So just the air conditioner dripped for the whole summer. It was a real horrible place.
It's a good old New York shithole dive.
Yeah. I mean, I've gone back there since. Now they have a plaque, and it's really trendy and stuff, but it was not trendy then.
Right.
And like even Sid Nancy, that was like the year before when Sid Nancy lived there. It was kind of where you ended up when you didn't have anywhere else to go.
Right.
But it was a lot of musicians, and a lot of junky musicians, and a lot of down and out authors and artists, and us.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and you ended up getting your own place. You stayed in New York for a while.
Oh yeah. After I got my place, I was first as a roommate. Yeah, I stayed there. Rockettes did really well, and then after that, I played a lot of bands after that. So. And I didn't move to L.A. till 91.
Oh, so you were there for like a decade?
A whole decade. But I go back and forth to London a lot. I joined a band, a band assigned to Epic, this English band, 20 Flight Rockers. I had to go back and forth. I went a lot and forth back and forth, London and New York. And it was easy to go back and forth. And I joined a band that was signed to Virgin called the Wild Frontiers, like in the late 80s. And then I came back to New York and I joined this girl that was signed to Geffen. And I became her musical director. And we did so many trips to L.A. because she was signed to Geffen out of L.A. that I eventually decided to move to L.A., to move back to L.A., but this time I lived in Hollywood instead of Canyon Country.
Do you remember where in Hollywood you lived?
Oh, the first place was on, what's the name of the street? It's right there off Melrose. Shoot, I can't think of the name of the street, but it's kind of where, it's funny, it's where, at the time, there's a really cool record store. It became the Von Dutch store, though. Spalding. It's Melrose and Spalding.
Yeah.
So Melrose, right, it's really close to Fairfax High. So we could walk around the corner to Cantor's. And I didn't have a car coming from New York. So it's a great place to live because I could walk to Cantor's. There used to be Mel and Rose's. There was a coffee shop there. There's a lot of great bars still, Mel, because Melrose hadn't become really trendy yet. A lot of secondhand stores. There's a motorcycle leather stores there. And then I got finished. I got a car, and then I moved around the corner to. I lived right behind Cantor's. After that, I moved whole three blocks away.
Stayed in the hood.
Yeah.
Were you doing session work when you were in both in New York and in L.A.?
Well, New York, I started doing lots of sessions. Because I used to work a lot with Richard Goddard, and after because he'd produced the Ripcords, and then during the 80s, he called me in for all these other projects. He's the one who hooked me up with that girl Willie Jones that got signed to Geffen, and he hooked me up with a bunch of different people that, and he'd call me in for a lot of session stuff. And Yeah, so I did a lot of sessions, but you know, and I played in lots of bands.
Yeah,
because I did because I remember I tried one after the Rockettes broke up. I got this job working on Fifth Avenue, working in a publishing house, and I was making $5 an hour. And I remember at the end of the week, I could pick up $2.50, and then they used to have a thing called New Music Seminar. And one night I played with four bands, and I made $150 for each band I played. So I came home with $600. I go, this is almost as much as I'm making a whole month. All I got to do is join as many bands as I can and play in as many bands as I can, and then I don't have to ever work again, and I'll make more money. So, and so after that, I started playing lots of bands.
Just became a gun for hire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Were you touring a lot?
No, I didn't tour. When I was living in New York, I didn't tour. But when I did do tours, like I went out with Willie, and I went out when her album came out on Geff, and I was a musical director. The Rockettes used to tour constantly. So I spent early eight, and the Ripcords too. Ripcords, we'd bounce between L.A., London, and New York, but every month we'd be moving. And with the Rockettes, we did 200 shows a year. So
damn.
Up until like 84 and 85, that's all I did. I just lived on the road.
So when you do New York, driving in a...
Yeah, we up, you know, the Rockettes started out like we had a van and we had our crew with us and we were pulling a trailer. Then we had a Ryder truck and we had just the band for the van. And then we got a Winnebago and we pulled a trailer. And then then the last tours we had a tour bus. So. But that was, but the best is when we had the crew in a Ryder truck and we had the whole van to ourselves, so just the band. So.
Right.
Yeah. So you get it got me because we got signed to RCA and Tommy Mottola was managing us at the time, so we were doing quite well.
What was Tommy Mottola like as a manager?
He's interesting. He's very smart. But the thing is, we'd done some demos with Mike Thorne, the guy who produced Soft Sound. We had these two demos that were getting a lot of attention, but we couldn't do the deal, so we went in. So Tommy Mottola called us in for a meeting, and he said, "We're trying to do this." He goes, "Like, well, I can get you a deal, and I'll get you a deal in 2 days." And so he said to us, "The next day, we were signed to RCA, just like that." Like,
damn.
Yeah. So he would, but then after we put the record out, he decided to kill the album. He said, "Because I'm going to sign you to MCA and get you a lot more money." So he said, "So they had our videos on heavy rotation," and he killed it. Like he said, "We're just going to have stop play. We're going to redo the song on MCA," and then we signed a really big deal with Irving Azoff at MCA. We were like the first band they signed to when Irving Azoff took over MCA. So it's like big stuff like that.
So he actually, it came through what he said.
Oh yeah, it came through. And then he said, and I remember him saying, because I remember him, he had a meeting with us in LA, and he was like, "Well, you know, this thing," and I go, "but right now we're like on heavy rotation. Trust me, because when this album comes out, if it doesn't go into top 10, this album, none of us should be in this business." Well, the record came out, and they did marketing research and decided the album couldn't break the top 10, so they kind of dropped the band. Even though we'd spent like $500,000 making it, and so Tommy Mottola not only stayed in the business, he flourished.
Right, but he left that whole thing.
Yeah, I remember him saying, "Hey, if this doesn't go top 10, none of us should be in this business."
None of us. He had to include everyone. Yeah.
Tommy says it's going to happen, but yeah, but what it was is they did a whole, and I remember them telling me they spent $50,000 to do some marketing research, and they figured out, and I go, "Why didn't they spend $50,000 promoting the album?" Why didn't they spend $50,000 finding out it's not going to break? They said the best they could do is it could break the top 40, but it can't break the top 10, the top 20 or something. Said so they don't want to promote it.
Damn! But you got a nice advance.
Oh yeah, a nice advance, and we spent a lot. It was ridiculous money. We had like we got the Studio A at Electric Ladyland. We had lockout for 30 days. We just had 24/7. Even when if I was down there, just hanging out partying, I could go to Electric Lady and go into the Studio A, and our gear was set up for 30 days. Like, which is ridiculously stupid money they were spending.
And that does not happen anymore.
No, it was like ridiculous. They're really like we got to get a sax player on this, and I remember. We go, and we said, "Oh man, and Tommy Mottola was down the studio." He said, "Because I saw David Sanborn last night on you and him." He goes, "Yes." The next day, David Sanborn's in the studio playing sax on her album. Like, he could just make a call, and we could pay him whatever they wanted.
Right.
So is that they wanted they wanted to get a vocoder on one song. So at that time, they were really rare. So they flew a vocoder up from Miami on a first class on a plane because it's really fragile and there's like only up to Electric Lady. And we had to pay the flight to get the vocoder up there and use it to play three chords on one song. And then they flew it back to Miami.
Oh, fuck.
It's like
money.
stupid money.
Yeah.
And we... So it's cool. And then we went to Studio C to do overdubs, and we mixed it in Studio B. But I mean, it's a legendary.
But you had a taste of that money as well, I'm saying. You guys
yeah.
Nice.
Well, we got equipment, but we didn't get rent money.
Okay.
We used to make good money playing live, but
right.
During this whole time, we didn't get rent money. We didn't get food money.
Right.
And, of course, we had the studio. We ate every day. They put everything on the tab. And
mm-hmm.
But we didn't get cash. We got all kinds of gear. I got tons of gear. I got eight guitars. I got a bunch of different amps. But I didn't get any money.
Right. Yeah, interesting story.
And I learned this story. And the lesson I learned from that is get the money. Like, the guitars don't mean anything. You only need one guitar, but you really need the money. So now I try to get the money. And I try to save money. When I get a production deal, I try to budget the money so that when it's over, we have money to split up. Instead of going, we have $500,000 to spend, let's spend $499,099, you know what I mean?
Right.
And let's, because we have all this money to spend, and now it's like, dude, let's make an album for $50,000 and let's all take $75,000 home when it's over. I mean, of course, numbers are a lot smaller these days. So nowadays, we have $5,000. Let's make an album for $400,000. Let's record a live one. But you know what I mean? But still, I learned, like, now to be frugal when you're recording and not to be stupid.
You don't have to spend it all. You don't blow it all.
No, you think that's what I think. That's, but I think it all started like the Beatles and stuff. They used to do. They say they do albums. They spend 6 months at Abbey Road, and people just throw money around. And bands like Def Leppard and Mutt Lang, they spent 2 years making an album in the studio. Like, and people just were stabbed. You know, that's what the kind of the era was. Get a massive advance. You never make your money back.
Yeah.
And spend every penny and live in the studio. And order food from the menus all day.
Yeah.
Not, and then go out and tour and struggle and get tour. So he gets tour support, and then you get tour support from, and they give you a bus.
Who are you going out with when you in these days?
Well, they always the Rockettes. The Rockettes song band. After that, I stopped. I didn't tour for a long time after that. I just stayed in town and recorded. And when I came to LA, I just did very few tours until.
Were you getting offered things, by the way, that you just turned down?
Not really. I got offered a couple of things. I played in the early 90s when I first moved to L.A. I went up and I played with Bob Dylan for a couple of weeks. And then we were going to do my first tour, and we were going to go to Australia. At that time, Howie Epstein was the band leader, and Howie Epstein brought me into it. And I was going to replace G.E. Smith and G.E. because G.E. didn't really want to do it anymore. And I knew G.E. from, because we used to, Rockettes toured a lot opening for Hall & Oates because Tommy Mottola managed them. So he put Hall & Oates and Rockettes together a lot. So I already knew G.E. And so when they said, we're going to get Danny, G.E. said, oh, Danny, he'd be good for this. So I went with a great 2 weeks, every day for 2 weeks rehearsing, we're going to do our first tour. And we did it, and that's when Bob Dylan had his whole heart. He had a heart condition. He had to go have heart surgery, and he had to take a year off. And when he came out of that, like a little over a year later, he decided to get a whole new start. He got a whole new band, all different younger people, and he got rid of Howie, and he got rid of everyone. Got rid of me, but I never really was in the band.
But you did 2 weeks of rehearsal.
2 weeks rehearsal, and he records everything. So
of course he was at all the rehearsals.
Yeah, it was at his house.
Who was in the band? I mean, who was on drums?
The drummer. I don't even remember who the drummer was, because me, Howie was the music director, and Bob would set. We'd sit in a little circle, and Bob wouldn't use the microphone, and we'd go over all the songs. And the drummer, they had him often I guess it's the patio of Bob Dylan's, like his Malibu house. And the drummer, they had him off in the distance, and they had him all mic'd. And everything was mic'd. So everything we did, they were recording. And there's an engineer that recording everything. And we tried different songs, and we were getting all the songs. He was trying all these new songs, and he'd play songs on cassettes. And then we'd sit there, and we'd have to learn the chords, and we'd try it. But the drummer was always in the background, and he never really, and then it'd just be me, Howie, and Bob, we would socialize. It'd be all work, then we'd take a break, and Bob Dylan would go. He'd go into the house, and we'd just sit there, sit this little table. Then he'd come out with a tray of tea and stuff, and we'd drink tea. And like, And it was just interesting. Then we were gonna, then they made me the offer to tour, and we were all set. And we hadn't actually, we hadn't actually gone into rehearsals. The plan was to go into rehearsals at SIR for a week and then go on tour. And so we hadn't actually gone into rehearsals. At that point, we'd just been doing, learning songs and stuff up at his house. So we never, but it never happened because then this girl, Debbie Gold, was working club, said, Bob has a heart condition and he has to go to New York and they might have to do surgery. And then I read in the press he had surgery, and when, like I said, when he came out, he got a whole new band. So, and so that was, they had Charlie Quintana. I think that's when Charlie first joined him. And I don't know, it might have been Kenny Aronson at the time that joined him on bass, but I know.
Yeah, that sounds right.
I know Charlie, but Charlie Quintana told me he got the gig because he's at a rehearsal space, and Bob Dylan walked in. And said, you know, he played and said, "Hey man, I'm looking for a young band to go on tour," and he got, and he hired Charlie. So.
Oh, they were, he was with the Plugs at that point.
Yeah, so he's a Plugs. Or something between the dance. So I knew Charlie really well. So he got this. It was like this.
How did
Bob,
you know Charlie, by the way?
Well, I met him at the Plugs back in the day, but then, and then when he played with the Cruzados. Is that the band he played in the Cruzados?
Yeah.
So that's my, and then I remember I opened for the Cruzados once in New York. And I got, so I got, then I, later on I played in a band with Charlie. I played in a couple bands with Charlie. So I played, Kathy Valentine had a band in LA called the Chosen Few that Charlie played in with me. And he's also in the band Javelinas, which Javelinas was two other former rock cats. So. And yeah, so I got to know Charlie. Rest his soul. I mean, you know, he's passed away.
Yeah. I was in touch with him, by the way, for a while. He was
really?
In Mexico.
Yeah.
We were trying to do something, but yeah, he wasn't going to leave Mexico. So.
No, I love Charlie, but he's really sad. He's a really good drummer, man.
Yeah.
I really like playing with him. He had a really good style. Yeah, but when he got the job after Bob Dylan recovered from his heart thing, that's when he put that band together, and I'm not sure. I know Charlie, that's about the time Charlie joined. I think probably that's when Charlie Sexton joined, but I'm not 100% sure.
Right, that whole The Love and Theft era.
I just know he got a new, he got younger bands. And he told Howie Epstein he wanted younger musicians.
That must have been also after Petty and the Heartbreakers were his backing band, right? And that's how he met Howie, and then he kept Howie.
Yeah, because when I joined Howie, because Howie's the one, he came down with Carlene. He came out with Carlene to see us play, and Carlene's the one that said, "You got to," because they came. Carlene Carter's one. Hey, brother man. Hey, dude. Good to see you. And Carlene's. It's funny. I was just on a cruise this past week, and I got to talk to Carlene. But so I've known Carlene for decades. But she brought down with Howie, and he said he'd be good for Dan. So they talked to.
So you didn't know Howie. That's how you met him.
No, I didn't know. I met him because then they called up Carlene to get my number from Carlene, and Carlene didn't know. And then finally they traced me, because they called me up and they go, "We've been tracing you down a lot because, you know, Howie really wants you to come down and play with Bob, and Carlene's been trying to get your number." And so I go, because they came down to see me play, and I knew, like I said, I already knew Carlene. So, but when I went up there, then I got to know Howie a little bit, you know what I mean? So.
Right.
But I'd never met him before.
Right, right.
This one I went to Carlene Stricker. You remember that? Like when you got me with Dylan, because you told Howie that he should hire me. And then he says, "Yeah," I guess, "yeah," but he took credit for it. He said it was his idea, but it was my idea.
he was really amazing, huh? I mean, I know he was producing, and he could sing, and he could.
Yeah, he was good.
He could just do it all. Was he struggling at that point?
Like I said, when those things with Bob Dylan, they'd start at noon and they'd end like at 7 o'clock in the evening. They did that for like two weeks. If I'm not mistaken, we took only one day off. And it's basically learning. All we learned, we went over hundreds of songs. This was a really weird, and they told me before, they set these rules when they went in. They said, "When you go in, he's going to ask you to suggest songs to jam on." He goes, "But don't suggest any songs of his songs. If you do, he'll probably stand up and just stop the whole thing. So don't suggest any of his songs." But even though we did do some of his songs, but he suggested, and they said, "And don't tell anyone who you're playing with. You can't tell people who you're playing with, and you can't." And they even told me before I went, they go, "You have to. Someone wants to hear you play. I can't tell." They told me, "I can't tell you who he is. He's really, really famous. I tell you that, but we're not allowed to tell because he doesn't want people to know he's looking for guitars."
So it was like he walked in, you didn't know?
No, but then the day before I left, they said, we'll call you tomorrow with the directions. They called me, and they gave me this address in Malibu. They go, okay, we'll tell you it's Bob Dylan. They says Bob, then they told me the date, so I knew I was going to his house, so I didn't have a chance to, like, bone up on anything, but it was really interesting. And we did a lot of rockabilly, we did a lot of R&B, a lot of covers, and then he had these cassettes with songs, and me and Howie, we learned the chords, and Bob would play the chords, and then we just, the three of us were like in a circle, and we had Jim, but I had to lean in to listen to Bob, because he has to sing that loud, and he wouldn't sing on a mic, and I had to lean in and listen to him sing, and like you said, Howie would add harmonies and stuff, but the drummer was like 40 feet away, and he had headphones on.
So, wow.
It was really interesting.
And did Bob open up a little at some point?
Yeah, like it was cool. Like, I remember, like, we'd take these breaks and he'd go get tea, and then he would talk a little bit, like, hey, do you read any books? What kind of books do you read? But no, he never really. And the whole time we did it, there's all these kids around there. There's like these nannies, like, watching these kids, and these kids were playing. It's a massive, like, I guess it's like the deck, but it's all fenced in. And, I mean, it's all windows and stuff, and it looks out the ocean. But there's all these kids playing in there and stuff too. It was so, and we were like in a little section that they had, like,
is he hosting maybe his kids' friends, that kind of thing?
I don't know.
I love it. You just don't. There's kids
and
here.
When you walk up and you have to go into the, you have to park down. I had to go into this little guardhouse. And I go in the guardhouse. It's not really a guard. It's like this kid, like this guy with long hair, like hippie dude. And it's like, dude, he's playing a Nintendo game. And they say, oh, they called up. They're going to send someone down to get you. So they don't let you drive up there. So when they come down to pick me up, and they walk me up the driveway. This is the first day. You walk up and there's peacocks running around, and there's all kinds of, like, there's like animal. I mean, there's like this.
Sounds
all
like Neverland.
Yeah, he has like all these like exotic animals on his property, and you walk up this big long driveway, and you get up there and with my guitar. Then the next days after that, the guard guy would take me up in a cart, but the guy, the guard, he wasn't like a really a guard. He was didn't have a badge. He just
had a gun.
Yeah, he had like it was like his little living room. He was down with the and he had coffee, and it was really it's what you expect from Bob. It was kind of like a hippie thing, but at the same time, it was like a mansion. It was a guardhouse, so
right. So that's a fascinating time.
You walk up there, it's beautiful property, but there's like peacocks and things running around and these exotic birds.
What money can do, right? Yeah. Too much money, you're buying peacocks.
Yeah, also. But not every day, and there's always someone as an engineer, and they never talk. This would always be recording everything, and when you sit up, they come over, they mic things up, and we take these breaks, and the drummer would stay over there. He wouldn't come and talk to us. And we didn't. I don't remember lots of it. It was surreal, really. And he was talking Bob, and he's always reading his book. I remember, I forget, he's had a book he's reading about artists, a biography. And he'd talk a little bit about the book he's reading. And he'd talk, so how long did you live in New York? Where were you from? You know, he was interesting. He asked you stories about your life, like where you're from, when did you first start playing guitar, like it's rockabilly, your favorite things. And then we go back to work.
Right.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
But it didn't happen. That tour didn't happen. That would have been my first tour after going to California.
Did you stay in touch with Howie at that point?
No, not really. I didn't really stay in touch with him that much. And I don't think it was that long after him and Carlene had all the problems and stuff. I think that's when everything.
Mexico.
Yeah, that was like 91, maybe 90. And I didn't really talk to him after that fell apart. And I didn't see him again. So, and I didn't see Carlene again until early 2000s at South By. So a decade later. Like I said, I just saw her last week. And it's her and me. I heard me written a song for the Go-Go's back in the day. So we'd written her and me, and Kathy Valentine wrote a song on the third Go-Go's album. And so I'd known her for a while. I'd known her since the early 80s.
While you were in a band with Kathy Valentine, or was this before?
Oh, no, this is before. This when she was the Go-Go's. She was going, because she was my girlfriend. I started dating her when they were doing the first Go-Go's album.
Okay, I didn't know that, so we'll throw that out. See, I did not know that.
Oh, yes, right. I started dating her when they did, because the Go-Go's used to live next to us in London, and they had another bass player at the time, Margo. And they were trying to be more of a punk band. And they came to L.A., and Richard Goddard, our producer, was going to produce them. But I also knew, by then I knew Belinda really well and Jane really well. And I remember they came to our show in L.A., and Belinda, because this is our new bass player, Kathy. And she gave me her number, but then they came to New York, and we were in New York for like 6 months, and they came to New York to their first album, so we started hanging out, and then we started dating. So during Beauty and the Beat, we start dating, and we kind of dated the whole thing off and on. But on the third album, we put a song that me and Carlene had written. They originally wrote it for the Rockettes. Kathy and me wrote it for the Rockettes. And it didn't go over that well at the Rockettes, but then one day she goes, hey, let's hang out with Carlene, and Carlene added some more words. So it became, then the three of us got together and finished the song. And then Kathy said, Belinda wants to do it on the Go-Go's album. So me and Carlene went, yeah, let the Go-Go's do it. We'll make a lot more money.
Yeah, what is that like, that kind of check when you're doing
well, it was originally going to be a single, but never got a single. I mean, we're talking about 1983, so right. For me it was big money. When I started getting like this $5,000 a month, that was, you know, for like, and it went on like that for a couple years. That's nice. That's one third of one song.
That's
see,
nice.
Imagine what you had if you had, you know, the whole song and the whole album, or half a song on every song, or.
Right.
But it was. I mean, it's good money. And the ASCAP checks were. That was the money from the mechanical world. But the ASCAP checks would be covered. There'd be a $500 ASCAP check, $2,000 ASCAP check. And it went on. It went on for years. I mean, still get money from it. But nowadays things have changed a lot. Now the check's $200 or 30 cents.
Right.
But back then it was good.
Those were the good days. Yeah.
I had to start my own publishing company and do a DBA out of New York City. But it was good. It was good to have that song that goes out.
Yeah, I bet, man. So these are good times. This is now you're living. We're back in Hollywood. Right, we're Bob Dylan post.
Yeah, 90. Yeah, I went to 91.
Yeah, you're still, and you are mostly doing, like, would we say rockabilly or?
Yeah, I was still doing rock, but I did a lot of country too. I was playing a lot of country and rock, but I also played like in bands, because the Rockettes weren't always we had synthesizers, and we did like rock and roll too. So, but it was never metal, and it was never punk, and it was sometimes a little poppy, but it's more rock and roll. I'd say it's more rock and roll than strict rockabilly. I wasn't in too many strict rockabilly bands. I never really was that strict. But during that time, then I started playing. Then I had a band called Big Rig Jackknife. They started this country band. It was like a cowpunk band. It was a guy, Jimmy Thrill, who used to be in a metal band, and Pamela DeBar managed us. And, you know, she was our manager.
What was she like as a manager?
Well, she's great. She's still a good friend of mine. She's a really sweet person. And she was sweet then. She was dating Jimmy Thrill, and that's how I met. That's how I met her. But she was your manager. We went on tour. We got Polly Parsons, who lives here down the hall. We talked Polly, who was like 19 then or something, to sing, because Pamela's going, you should be a singer, since your Grand Parsons, your daddy, you should be a singer. But Polly couldn't really sing. But we did a whole tour. We went and played every place that we went to. Waycross, where Graham went to elementary school. We went to Odessa, where he went to junior high. We played Nashville. We played all these places, and where Graham was from. And we met all of Graham's. When we went to Waycross, we met like his elementary school friends. One of them become the mayor of the town, and we went to Odessa. His best friends wanted to become the local pharmacist and ran the pharmacy, and so we met all of Graham's friends, and it was Polly. But then we got off the tour. Polly said she's never singing again. So, but we're still friends. She lives in Austin. So.
Right.
So Polly.
So, you're still in Hollywood at this point.
Yeah.
And. And by the way, so how do you end up meeting? You knew Slim Jim. How do you get hooked up with Lemmy?
Well, I met Lemmy. He's one of the first people I met in London. We went to London. Me and Levi played Dingwalls, and Lemmy used to live in Camden Town. And I didn't know much about Motorhead, but I knew about Hawkwind because I listened to him when I was like 13 as in progressive rock. So I knew who Lemmy was. But Lemmy came down to Dingwalls to see us play. Like, this would be the summer of 1980. And I remember going, wow, there's Lemmy. So I went up and introduced myself, and he's really cool. And he said he really liked rockabilly, and he's looking forward to seeing us. But then he started coming to our gigs. And so me and Levi learned that song Motorhead Baby, the Johnny Guitar Watson song. So whenever he would be in the audience, we'd dedicate Motorhead Baby to him, and we play that. And that's exactly how Slim Jim met him too. He showed up at a Stray Cat show, and I think it probably was at Dingwalls. And he was always a big rockabilly fan. So over the years we stayed friends, and then I'd see him at the Scrap Bar in New York City, and I'd see him at the Rainbow in L.A. So we always went to the same bars, and I always say hi, and we weren't close friends or anything. But about it wasn't until, I guess, the late 90s. This means Slim Jim started the band 13 Cats. And 13 Cats then became, it evolved into being the Swing Cats. And that was with Lee Rocker. Lee Rocker, me and Slim Jim had a band. We did two albums, the Swing Cats. And Lee did...
Yeah, who was, by the way, who was 13 Cats, though?
But 13 Cats was, that was Tim Pole, Cat from the Pole Cats, is me and Smutty. Smutty was from the Rock Cats, and Slim Jim. Because we start that band as 13 Cats because there's like everyone's in the Cat band. And they did all right. We did all that band, but during that whole time, Brian hit big with his orchestra, and Cleopatra Records said that he told me and Slim Jim, I mean, if you guys get Lee, I'll give you guys, it gives a really a lot of money to make an album. If you make like a swing album, but Lee said, I don't want to do a swing album, but I'll do a Jump Blues album and we'll have like horn players on it and stuff. So we did those two albums. But the third album, we were going to do a tribute to Elvis. And by then, and Lee said he really couldn't do it anymore. He was too busy with his own stuff. So we decided, so we got all guests appearing. Everyone's on that. But one of the, you know, we have Michael DeBar on that, Kathy Valentine, forget all the people. Jamie James and the King Bees, but we decided to get Johnny Ramone and Lemmy to be on it. But so we talked to Johnny and we talked to Lemmy. But Johnny was like, I called Johnny, and Johnny go, we'll do just the same key as the original. There's two Elvis songs. It was Viva Las Vegas and Good Rockin' Night. And we'll do the same tempo. So we went and cut the songs with Johnny. And then Lemmy came in to sing the vocals. So he sang Good Rockin' Night, and then he went to sing Viva Las Vegas. He went, oh no, man, this is the wrong key for me. I don't like this key. And I go, well, Johnny wanted to do the original key. He goes, well, I can't sing this. He goes, you pick up the bass, I'll pick up acoustic guitar. Jim, get on the drums, and we cut two songs. Like, all shook up, and I'm trying to get to you. And he said, Dad, and then he said, no, we should start a band. And that was like 1999, end of 1998, and so, and we said, yeah, but I'm sure the record company lets do an album, so. Let me say, yeah, let's do an album. So that's it. So we did. So that's how Headcat started. But so we did an album.
But we're supposed to be two songs, right?
Yeah, but he said, when the three of us played together and cut it, he said, we should be a band. So we cut the first album, that one that became Fool's Paradise. We cut it with me playing bass, then me playing acoustic, Jim playing drums. And I had a studio at home by then. I'd take the tapes. It was ADAT tapes. I'd take them home every night, and I'd add electric guitar to it, and I'd add keyboards to it, like piano, some organ on it. And then I'd take it back down the next day to the studio, and they'd hear what I did. And then I replaced so that first time I played guitar and bass and keyboards, and Lemmy plays acoustic, and he plays harmonica on the song. And that's the first album. It's only supposed to be one album, but people started asking us to play live, and we did a couple shows, like the Millennium 1999, 2000, we played the show, then we played a show 2001. In 2004, they asked us to make a live DVD, and we did a live DVD, and we had to get a bass player, because I played bass on the record. And after that, Lemmy goes, I don't want to play guitar anymore, I'm going to play bass. So then we became a trio. And then we start playing a lot as a trio, and we got a lot louder. When Lemmy plugged in his bass, the volume went through the roof. Like
loudest guy you've ever played with.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because even though he's half stacked, but still, like, he'd turn in and he'd tell me before he goes to stage, he'd go, Dan, make sure you're loud enough. And I go, everything's on 10. I can't. So but it was Lemmy playing on 10, and I didn't have his double stack, but playing clubs, and playing some small clubs.
Right.
You know, we were playing clubs, and he was still on, everything's on 10. So some of those nights were, wow, they were so loud. But we played a lot of those shows. We did the second album, and then in about 2011, that's when Lemmy started he got sick, and he had a defibrillator put in, and that's when he started having health problems. And probably around that time, he started canceling Motorhead tours, and now obviously that was his main band. So if he canceled a Motorhead tour, then when he felt better again, he had to go make up those dates. So there really wasn't a lot of room for Headcat, although we did get to do three Headcat shows the last year in 2015. And for his 70th birthday, December 13th, 2015, Headcat was supposed to do three songs, and we went down. I went out to LA, and he came. Lemmy showed up at the sound check, and everyone was there. Slash was playing. Slash was playing. Steve Vai was playing. Billy Idol was playing. Matt Sorum was playing. The Black. The can't think of his name off the Zach Wilde.
Oh, Zach Wilde.
I think the name Black Label. It's the Black Label Society. I was starting to think of the name of the Black Label Society instead of just thinking of his name, Zach Wilde played. But all these people played for Lemmy's birthday. So Lemmy showed up at the sound check and Dixon said, no, that's when I saw him, and Lemmy looked really sick. He was really frail then. And Dixon said, no, Lemmy doesn't want to rehearse. So we went back up the Rainbow, and I got to hang out with them. I sat with them at the Rainbow, and everybody was packed because everyone's getting ready to come to his birthday party. And then we finally got him up there. And we went back up to do the party. And we got me and Slim Jim, his son Paul, Matt Sorum, and Matt Sorum's wife. We all got on stage, and we played the Beatles version of Happy Birthday to Lemmy. And we'd set up Lemmy's amp. And the plan was, as soon as we finished, Matt was going to introduce Lemmy, and Lemmy's going to come up, and we'd do three Headcat songs. But his tech, Steve, came up to us. It was American tech, because his American tech came up to us and said, Lemmy doesn't feel good enough to play. So he didn't play, and we said happy birthday to Noick. And then I went up there, and I gave him a hug. Then they said, Dixon, I'm taking Lemmy out of here now. He wants to go home. So I gave him a hug, and then 2 weeks later, he passed away. So. But I knew he was sick today, but I had no idea. But I've seen Lemmy sick, because he got a couple of times. We played once in Green Bay, and he had pneumonia, and he was so sick. But he'd always get better. And he had a fibrillator in him, and he got better. You know what I mean? So
right.
I think soon he's going to go back, rest, and he was going to get better. So.
Yeah, he was just, you couldn't kill Lemmy, exactly.
Yeah.
That idea, yeah.
No.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you saw him.
Yes. Yes, yeah, so we played, so from after knowing him in 1980, from 1999 to 2015, we played off and on, and we did records. So it was 15 years we did Headcat. I remember we had our 10th anniversary, we played New Year's Eve on 2009, 2010. I go, it's like the 10th anniversary of our first show, and he goes, I can't believe my side band has been together 10 years. I'm getting old.
Really wild, though. That's a good point. I didn't hear that.
You said,
way.
My side band is 10 years old.
That's fucked up. Yeah. We don't need that shit. When did you move here? You were saying, what year was it?
About 2009. Well, exactly 2009.
And what prompted that?
Well, I was in the 2000s, I was living in LA. I did a lot of film stuff. In the 2000s, I got lucky and I got to do a lot of film stuff starting. So I did a score to a movie called The Rage, Carrie 2 for MGM. And it was actually number one at the box office for a couple weeks. And then it got knocked out by Analyze This. And so that was good. I did 5 or 6 films. And then that money, I love that money. And I love composing. And my studio is good then. So, and being that I did that film and I was the composer on a studio film that was number one, it was pretty lucrative. But so I was able then to play music and do whatever I want. I didn't really worry about playing the gigs at the clubs. And I also, during that time, I got the gig with Nancy Sinatra. And so I was touring with Nancy Sinatra. And the way she toured, we'd only go out for the weekends. So she'd fly us out, and she'd rent a big sound stage, and we'd rehearse in the sound stage. We'd go, she'd fly us out. We'd stay in 4-star hotels. Ugh. And we'd do a show, do one or two shows, pretend we'd come back. And we did that pretty much until we did one 5-week tour of Europe with her, because Morris, she put a label out of Morrissey's record label. I can't think of the name of the label, but she put a Sanctuary. She put a record on Sanctuary. So we did a tour, but and after that she decided to retire again. But
how did you even get that gig?
Because at the time I was doing lots of albums, all these different bands I was doing, and I could never record drums at my home studio. So Gilby Clark from Guns N' Roses, he had a great home studio, and so I'd go down and use Gilby would engineer, and I'd always record. It'd either be Clem Burke or it'd be Slim Jim, and they're all his friends. So and we'd record the drums and bass at his studio, and I'd do the overdubs of mine. But Gilby was playing at the time. Gilby and Clem were playing with Nancy Sinatra. She decided to put together like a band of super. So Gilby was playing, and she only played once every 2 or 3 months or something. So, and one day she had a gig and she couldn't do the gig. And Gilby said, "Hey man, you read music, right?" And I go, "Yeah." And he's like, "Dude, you want to do this gig with Nancy for me? I'll give you the charts." And I go, "Nancy?" I said, "Yeah." So she sent his road manager over, and he took a Polaroid of me so she could see what I looked like. And they gave me the charts, and Gilby gave me the charts. So then the day I went in to rehearse for the shows, when I came in, she said to me, just make sure you're not going to quit on me if you join my band like Gilby did. And I go, what? Like, and I go, no, Gilby quit. She says, yes, Gilby quit. I go, Gilby loves you. And she's like, oh, yeah, I'll let you read the emails. And you can see how much she loves me.
Whoa.
This is I mean, she was hurt. By the way, it wasn't that bad. But so I went. And I go, I had to use the restroom. I went and I called Gilby. I go, Gilby, what's going on? He's like, I'll tell you, man. You take the gig, man. Nancy and me we're kind of fighting right now. But so you take the gig. You'll be perfect. I go, you sure? He's like, yeah, you take the gig. But what it turned out is, if she got mad at Gilby, she said, Gilby, I can't believe you're canceling my gig. You're canceling my gig because he had some production thing to do. And he said, well, if you played more often and took your career more seriously, I would. And so that was, it hurt her feelings. Mm. But he just said, if you took it more, like, you know, and we played more often, then I could. So, and he didn't mean, and they've been since, they made up right away, and Gilby came to our gigs, and I've hung out with her and Nancy. But that particular day, she was upset with him.
Scorned woman.
Yeah, she's upset with him. But he said, no, take the gig. It's fine. You'll be perfect for it. Yeah, they made up right away. But that's what it turned out. It was that line, if you took your career more seriously, yes, I'd be able to dedicate all my time to you.
Right.
And so that was like, what do you mean?
You don't talk to Nancy Sinatra like that.
And it's because at that time she'd only take, right, like she'd go, oh, I'm gonna go play with Morrissey's, gonna have us play here. She went to the cool things. She's smart.
That sounds like a very cushy gig. That was great.
Nancy's one of the coolest people. Lemmy and Nancy are the two coolest people I work with. And they're the two biggest stars, and they're the most down to earth. The first gig we did at the Bumper Shoot Festival, we rehearsed the sound stage. I flew up the saddle, and I get the thing in my hotel room, be down in the lobby at 1 o'clock to get the van to the. So I go down, so I'm sitting there. Nancy's sitting there, and people come and get her autograph. I'm sitting next to her. I turn, are you waiting for your car? Is their car going to pick you up? She's like, I'm in a band. Can I get in a van with you? And I go, oh, yeah, of course you can. And she did. Her and her boyfriend, she got in. Not only did she get in our little passenger van, her and her boyfriend climbed to the back seat, the back bench seat.
Right.
And she did. And so she always would travel with us, and we toured the 5 weeks we did in Europe. She was on the tour bus with us, and she'd always make sure we stayed in the same hotels with her, our days off. She'd have what she called a family dinner, and she'd take the whole band and the crew. We'd have a big dinner with everyone, and she would pick up the tab. And she was just, yeah, I've gone to McDonald's. She's hungry. I've gone to McDonald's with her. I stood in line at Pat's Philly Steakhouse in Philadelphia after a gig with her. It's like, she's so down to earth. You know what I mean?
Is she telling stories about Dad?
No, that's funny. It's just funny. When I first joined, I just said something. They go, oh, if you do good, you earn the right to tell a story about her dad. Because the thing is, everyone she meets all over the world, they go, oh, I got a story about Dad. It's always, right, when my mom was a kid, your dad, and so, I got a story about your dad.
Right, she's just so. Yeah.
So the joke is, if you do something good, you get to tell her a story about her dad. But that was the joke. But the coolest thing, but we played this. It's before we moved to Texas. We came out and we played the Habitat for Humanity down in Lockhart. And I played, and we had to back up Frank Sinatra Jr. as well. And I didn't know, at the time they flew us into Houston and took us by cars over to Lockhart. So I didn't know Lockhart was so close to Austin. And I still don't know why we flew into Houston and didn't fly into Austin. But you just say we stayed in Lockhart for a week. We did this thing. But then the night after the show, we went to Frank Sinatra Jr.'s ex-wife, who's a woman named Barbara. I don't know if she's a senator. Previous senator of Congress. We went to her house and we're having like a dinner there. And I'm sitting at the table. And she's like, and it's Nancy, and she goes, do you remember Dad used to come in? And he'd take that, I had that transistor radio, and he'd take it from me because I listened to rock and roll. And she goes, oh, that's nothing. He said, I was hanging. He'd wake me up in the middle of the night, and he'd say, Ernie Kovacs wanted pizza. And they'd send me, and they'd tell me stories. They go, well, yeah, nigga, and he'd wake me up, and they'd be, Dean, they want pizza because they'd been up all night. And they'd send me to get pizza like at 10 in the morning in my car. Like, and you're thinking, like, well, they're 10, like, wow, they're talking about Frank Sinatra. They're talking about their dad. How difficult he was, but they're talking about Frank Sinatra. So it's kind of weird to be a fly on the wall and just listen to them say, remember that time? And they go, oh, I had it worse than you. You didn't have to drive to get pizza. And Ernie Coase would be there in his underwear. Like, he'd be sitting in his underwear because so we had no air conditioning. Remember that? He wouldn't buy air conditioning.
I love it.
And then he goes, Frank. And I come back with the pizza and they'd all be passed out. Like, And yeah, she said, oh, you come up and you should listen to the Twins. She used to tell the story, and so she'd be listening, she'd have to listen to the transistor radio, listen to rock and roll, because they weren't allowed to listen to rock and roll.
Right.
But it's funny to hear them tell these stories, and they're, and her and Frank, they're trading stories of their childhood. Like, but you're going, wow, they're talking about Frank Sinatra.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's probably no more famous father.
Except for the fact they're dropping names like Ernie Kovacs and Dean Martin and people hanging out all night with their dad. It's pretty much, the stories are all the same. He wakes me up and makes me get pizza, makes me do this, and won't let me do this, and grounded me. And
get up.
He grounded me. That's kind of stuff.
Me and Ernie are hungry. I love it. We want pizza.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. But what got you here? You were saying.
So what happened? So 2006, I started playing this duo, the Lonesome Spurs, and we were signed to Cleo, and it was this girl, Linda K. Parker, Linda K., and she's from Austin, so she had kept her apartment here. She's living out in L.A., and she'd done some acting, and she did a lot of, like, she did some musical stuff and stuff, so we started coming here a lot. My brother is a first AD in film, so he was living here in Austin, and he had a house, so he had an apartment that was half the time empty, so I started spending 4 months a year out here, and we'd come out here and play out, base ourselves out Texas, and go back to Hollywood and base ourselves. A lot of time we spent in Texas. And then I start realizing, like, Headcat at that point is making enough money that I didn't need to live in LA anymore. And that's the only thing I was really doing. I wasn't doing movies anymore because it kind of dried up and things, and it leads in that direction. I'd gone through a divorce, and so I just started thinking, man, I loved Austin. I come here, I knew just as many people in Austin as I did in L.A. And so I started thinking, I'd rather live here. And then I remember I checked in. Rosie Flores said she's in duplex. She said, duplex is opening up next door. You want to move here? And the rent was like $700. It's a two-bedroom with a two-bedroom house. I go, that's like more than I'm paying. I'm renting a room with this guitar maker in Echo Park. I'm paying $900 a month for a room, you know? And so I go, I can have a house for $700. I can keep that and still have both places. But after like a couple months of having both places, I never really went back. I just go back to play then. So.
Yeah, you just stayed.
Yeah. And I mean, I still go back. Like I was back there last week because right now I'm producing two songs for Ann Margaret's record. And so Ann Margaret's doing a new album. So I did one.
The Ann Margaret?
Yeah. So I did one song with her. I did a duet with her and Mickey Gilley. And the other one I just did with her singing, but I got Paul Schaefer to play piano on.
How do you get involved with Ann Margaret? How does that happen?
Well, it's through Cleopatra. They called me up and they asked me if I wanted to do, because I did a lot, and I just did the new Del Watts album with Cleopatra, which is coming out, which is going to be a great album. They released the single. It's a duet with him and Laurie Morgan. And then they asked it, then they kind of, and they wanted Ann Margaret to do something more like up, like 50s stuff or some R&B stuff, but they wanted to be more up-tempo and not like standards or something. So they got me involved, and so I went out there. She had a screening, of "Bye Bye Birdie," her song, her movie from the early '60s. And then they did a Q&A with her, and they played 30 seconds of each of the songs I produced for the audience.
Gotcha.
The first. Yeah, I'll show you the picture. She looks great. She's 82 years old.
And Margaret, damn.
There you go. Yeah, there's me and there's me and my wife and her.
She looks like Ann Margaret.
It's like that's
unbelievable.
That's like from 3 weeks ago.
She looks like Ann effing Margaret.
Yeah.
Still.
Yeah. Yeah, so,
she's over 80. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Come on. Yeah. I mean.
So, and, you know, so we're doing that album. So we got to go meet her, and it was cool afterwards.
Legend.
To talk to her. So, yeah. So I still go to L.A. a lot. And we played. And on Christmas, we went out, and we did a show where we played. We went out, me and Annie went out, and they wanted us to play the Cleopatra at the Viper Room. So we played and we opened for the Dictator. I'm sorry, the Dickies. So we opened for the Dickies, and I put a band together, and I got Clem Burke I use Clem Burke on any time I can.
Right.
He's been like 8 of the albums I produced. So I got Clem Burke on drums, and so we played the Viper Room. So,
right.
And so it's like, I still go back there. When I do go back, it's like the same places I've played the Viper Room so many times over the past two decades. So
Yeah.
And I see the same people I know, the same people are still hanging out. Then I go up to the Rainbow, and even though Lemmy's not there anymore, I still know the people that work there. I know, and so I go up there and see a lot of people I know from when I used to hang out there. Lemmy, they still hang out there, and so it's I still go back, but I like Austin a lot better.
Yeah,
I look now, I go back to LA only for work.
It's more more real here. You're out of it, but in it.
It was like when I first moved here, like, you know, living in California, and I was living in Echo Park before. Before I got divorced, I had this big ranch, I had this horse ranch. It was up in Agua Dulce, which is way up there. And I used to commute all the time. And my ex-wife was in the film business, so she'd have to commute all the time. But when I got divorced, I moved down to Echo Park. So I was in the center of things, but still being in the center of things, if my friend is playing in Long Beach, it means he's an hour away at least. And if I have a gig in Long Beach, I have to be at soundcheck. I have to leave 2 hours before soundcheck. And then people play here, then they're playing in the Valley, then they're playing on Thousand Oaks, they're playing in Hollywood. And so there's no way you're always driving all the time. So I like when I moved here, the place I'm living is 2.5 miles from downtown.
Right.
And I could go in one night, I could go see 8 different bands, you know what I mean? And there's never nothing any more than 5 miles away from where I wanted to go. So So I like that freedom. Whereas in LA, I put like 200 miles a day on my car sometimes, driving in Hollywood, driving in Long Beach. And here I'd put like 200 miles a month on my car, you know? And I love that. That's why I liked about Austin. I didn't have to. Now, if I ever have to move out, and I know Austin's getting more expensive, if I ever have to move outside and start more people having to do, then I might not like it as much.
You think that might happen, though, where you might have to move outside?
I know people now. I knew musicians now that are living up in Georgetown.
Yeah.
Which isn't that far when there's no traffic, but when there's traffic, that 35 is one of the... I mean, it's as bad as any place I've ever seen. They didn't really design it to take all those trucks and all those cars, and it goes through the center of town. So see, it's a 35 can be horrible, so...
Right. It can be the 405.
Having said that, the 101 and the 405 and the Harbor Freeway, those freeways are in the 5 in a lot of places. Those you basically have 3 hours to go 30 miles sometimes.
Yeah.
No, so having said that, LA is still a lot worse.
Can I ask you real quick, go back about the Palomino? You said you played there a lot. You were in Who was there then? You get the shirt?
Well, I got the for the movie.
Oh shit!
Because nice. I got interviewed for the movie.
Oh, he's got the T-shirt, folks.
Yeah, it's the Palonium.
Palomania.
So I got. Yeah, because I got back in the... Because, like I said, when I played the Palomino, when I was about 17, I started... My first professional gig, when Elvis died in 77, and about 3 months later, John Wilkinson, who's his rhythm player, he's the guy that's in all the Vegas videos, he's the one that played the 335 and stood on the outside next to James Burton. He'd actually been a singer-songwriter before he joined Elvis. So he started doing shows, and he came in... I was working in a music store giving lessons when I was 16, and he wanted a bass player. So he hired me to be his bass player. So I went out and I started playing with him, and I learned all the Elvis. We were doing Elvis songs and stuff, but then all the Elvis fans would come to him, you know what I mean? And he would also tell me lots of Elvis stories. I was only 16 or 17 then, but he told me tons of Elvis stories. I was touring with Elvis and stuff, because he toured with Elvis for 10 years. So one day this guy comes in, I can't remember his name, he managed Eddie Arnold. And he came in and he had this young kid, there's going to be Elvis in person, he had this bright idea, he was going to get Elvis's band to back him up, which was never going to happen. So he came in to talk to John, and of course John said, no way. But then he liked the band backing up John, and so he asked us if we wanted to be in the band, so... I said, yeah, but I said, I actually play guitar, not bass. So I got the gig, this Elvis impersonator, and then we were playing the Palomino, we started playing the Palomino once a month, because they used to have a lot of dead Dennis Colt, Mike Wilcox, and this guy I played was named Michael Kidd, and they had a lot of Elvis impersonators playing the Palomino. And from that, people started playing as a good guitar player, and so I started getting all these gigs with different country people. The house guitarist and the house band, he asked me to fill in for him for a couple weeks. We went on vacation. During that week, I got to fill in for him. I got to back up Johnny Paycheck. '78. It was in '78. Yes, I got the backup. '17. I got the backup Johnny Paycheck. He came in with just his piano player and no band.
What was he like?
Well, it changed my life. He's this rock. I remember he came in. We rehearsed with the piano player. We know what we're gonna do. And the Palomino has this little side door off the side of the stage. There's a lot of people that she could pop out the side of the stage and have a cigarette. And so he was sitting in his white limo on the phone, and he had these two girls with him. And he sat there the whole time we rehearsed. And finally, when the piano player went out, I said, okay, the band's, you know, they rehearsed, come in and sing a song. And so he came in, and he comes walking through the front door with his arms around these two girls' waist, and they're, and he has this big hat on, but they're still like 2 feet taller than him. And they're gorgeous. They're like, and they got mini skirts on and high heels. And he comes walk after gets out of his limo and he walks in with them. And he comes up and he's saying, "Take this job and shove her in A11." He sang that with us for, that was it. Then we didn't see, we went on, we did a set with him later. We did the set, but that was my. But I'm thinking, I'm just kidding. Wow, look at those girls! Look at those girls he's with, because they were really hot.
Rock star.
Yeah, and he was. And then like a year later, he was bankrupt. You know, his just, and then like, and when he passed away, he was penniless. You know, Chris Christopherson paid for his funeral. So I guess he'd made all that money the year before from Take This Job and Shove It. So that's how he lived it. And so he
squandered his fortune on the
yeah,
ladies.
He had these ladies. He had a phone. He's talking to phone. I know now, like back then, talking to phones in cars were, it's like probably amazing expensive to talk on phones in your house.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He had the money. So he's just spending it.
Johnny Paycheck.
I just go, wow, look at those girls. Like,
no, I want that job.
He's like that. Like, even with this big hat, they're still taller than his hat. And he's like, sit down, ladies. And then I remember they poured it. They went over and they poured him like a whiskey. And he came up on the stage. He had a suit on. It was... And that's it. So I mean, so as rock and roll as anything I've ever seen. I mean, and I drink tons of Jack Daniel with Lemmy, and we've had tons of girls hang out with us. But Johnny Paycheck was as rock and roll as anything I've ever seen.
I love that. I love that. That's beautiful, Johnny Paycheck.
Yeah.
But who else was there at the Palomino at the time?
Like, well, I used to go see everybody. I saw Jerry Lee, who's now my uncle. I saw him a lot. I saw Carlene Carter there when she first came down in 1979. And later when I met her, I told her I'd seen her show. I saw Ricky Nelson there. I'd hang out there a lot because I knew by then I played there so much I could always sneak in the back door when it sold out. And I saw Fred Axton would play there a lot.
Wow.
That's what kind of changed my life because, like I said, I went Levi and the Rock Cats had come to town, and I was kind of a little into rockabilly, but I had like, you know, I looked like any 70s Southern California kid playing in the country band. I wear a cowboy hat. I had like long blonde hair, longish blonde hair, and wore. And I went in, so I went down to see Levi and the Rock Cats. And I just done a show where we do this 50s thing, since I combed my hair up in a quiff. So I went down to see them, and I walked in the back door, sold out, and their manager, Lee Childers, saw me. He's like, hello. He goes, hey, you play in a band? I go, yeah, I'm a guitar player. They go, oh, and then he goes, do you want to meet the band? So he took me backstage and introduced me to Levi and the Rock Cats. And right away, like, I'm like, they're like the same age as me. Actually, Levi's like a year older than me. Because they go, do you play here? And they're like, you're a teenager? And they go, so we became friends instantly. And so that kind of led to, that was in the summer. Then in December, I went to their show at the Starwood. I walked in, and Smutty and Dibs, doing the Rock Cats, they said, hey, we fired Levi today. We want you to join the Rock Cats, and Dibs would be the singer. Do you want to join? I went, yeah, I want to join. And I went in the dressing room, and Levi goes, I quit the Rock Cats today. I want to start a new band and move to London. Do you want to start a band and go to London? And I went, that's a better. So that's why the whole time as Levi, the Rock Cats kept telling me, why don't you quit Levi? Come join the Rock Cats. So they kept the offer up for like a year and for almost 2 years until I finally took them up on it and joined the Rock Cats. But it's kind of like playing the Palomino. That's kind of put me on this whole different course where I went to play with these trendy rockabilly bands and started playing with, playing real straight country.
Yeah.
And it led to this whole thing where I'm like, now I'm like in these trendy bands in New York, and I could go into Studio 54, and they knew the bands that they knew to roll.
All because of the Palomino.
Yeah, because I met them at the Palomino.
It's beautiful, isn't it? How that works.
And now the Palomino's getting recognized. So when I did the interview for them, and I showed them, like, actually I got a picture of me on stage back then from like 1978. But I showed them, like, yeah, I played. That was, it's funny, and it was a great club. It still was. And it's completely different.
So, what's going on? I mean, today you were these days.
Yeah, that's me at the Palomino.
That's beautiful. with Elvis. Yes. There he is.
That's what I look like.
Damn, bro. Look at you, man. You look so California. I love it.
Yeah, that's what
right?
I
said.
And my hair was just, it wasn't, it was long. I could still grease it up. So when I started doing rock, I could still grease it up. It was like
with
a long,
the white suit.
Yeah.
Damn, man. Crushing it. I love it.
Yeah, that was on stage at the Palomino, so.
I love it, man. What's going on with you today? Anything? Like, what are some of the things you would like to?
Well, the thing, the Dale Watson album comes out April 22nd. I produced that. I'm really proud of that.
Where did you record it?
We had to do it all over the place. I used the drummer Adam Hamilton, who plays with LA Guns. He's a big session guy, but he's also a session. He did the drums out in LA. I did the bass here and some of the bass in Memphis. Dale did his vocals in Memphis, but most of the stuff I recorded here. And I sent the tracks out and got the drums done in California by Adam.
You're producing?
Yeah, I produced it. And I played. Dale doesn't play any guitar. Dale just sings on it.
Interesting.
Yeah, Dale. So
was that your choice?
No, he went. The idea was I was going to produce all the backing tracks, and he was going to put the vocals down. He doesn't need my direction on the vocals because, you know, he knows it all covers, so he knows exactly what he's going to sing. So he doesn't need me there, and I did all the back rubs. So I got all the heart, and then I organized, like, Lori Morgan to sing the duet, and I got Linda Gail Lewis to do a duet, and then I got Steve Cropper to come play on it.
Nice.
Because I done the album, because last year I did the album for Robert Gordon. I got Steve Cropper on that one, so I'd already made a connection with him. And yeah, so I'm proud of that. It's coming out. And then today, the Anne Margaret stuff for them doing. We'll see. So that's what I'm doing now.
Right. You've had a lot of lives.
Yeah, and this week I'm going to the studio because, you know, I'm doing a new project with David Vincent.
Interesting.
Then, you know, he joined, you know, after Lemmy passed away. We got offered to go play Vodka in that big metal festival, me and Slim Jim. So we got David Vincent to set in for Lemmy. And so since then, me and David have been working a lot. Me and David actually did a country record as well. It's a country singer. But this week we're going in to do things. It's along the line of Headcat. It's like loud, kind of really loud rock and roll.
Nice.
So we've already done. We did four songs before COVID. So now we're going to, now after COVID, we're going to pick it up. And hopefully we'll get that album done soon.
Make a full record.
Yeah. And we have to do it this week because next week he's on tour with I Am Morbid for like 2 months. So this whole week, Mari's going to the house to do songs. Wednesday we rehearse. Thursday and Friday we're in the studio all day. So
look at you, man. Seriously, it's a lot of lives in that. In all these different. You've had your foot in different.
Well, the funniest story anyone ever says. I was going to do. Nancy Sunter, she'd go out every year and she'd play on Memorial Day. She'd play in front of the Washington Monument, right there in front of the Lincoln Memorial, with their back on the mall. And she'd go out and play, and she'd play for the Rolling Thunder, which is all the war vets that take their bikes in. So she did that every year. So, well, she didn't do it every year, but she'd win every year. But this year she's going to play. And so then I also had a show with Headcat. So, and Nancy, at that time, she's. Because she'd always went to soundstage, and she'd be a fortune. So I remember Don said, "We just have to go to this one show. Do you know it?" And he said, "Do you know any rehearsal place that's cheaper?" So there's this place called Rehearsal. So I rehearsed in there with Lemmy, and we learned that song, Back in the USA, the Chuck Berry song.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we learned that song. And so then, I told him, like, we can rehearse. I rehearsed there with Lemmy. We can rehearse. It's good enough for us. So it's not, and so they thought, oh, that'd be great. Nancy, appreciate the scene. So Nancy came in there and rehearsed. The next day, I rehearsed in the same studio with Nancy. And Nancy goes, I'm going to do some Back in the USA. She goes, does anyone have the words to it? And I go, I have a CD I burnt last night of Headcat. So she went over and listened to us playing it to try to write down the lyrics Lemmy was singing, because she went to get the word. And I go, and the bass player went, there's not many people said they rehearsed in the same studio doing the same song 2 days in a row, the first day with Lemmy and the second day with Nancy Sinatra. But Nancy's already listening. So what's he singing there? Like, and she's writing the lyrics out to the song.
Nancy's not to transcribing Lemmy.
Yeah, and so she went to do that song for the Memorial Day.
Beautiful.
And so we did the Headcat show, and then the next day, I went from the Headcat show straight to the airport and flew to Washington, D.C. and played on the mall, like, with Nancy Sinatra, and did the same song. But yeah, they're in the same rehearsal space. Dude, didn't people say they did the same song with Lemmy one day and Nancy Sinatra the next?
Can I ask you real quick, too? When you do in the studio, does Slim Jim stand or sit?
Slim Jim likes to sit in the studio, but I think it's because mainly because he's cutting for a long time,
Oh no, I was just gonna say no. I get the lie. I get that. I mean, I get that. But in the studio, he will sit.
Yeah, he sits. Okay. And in funny, when we first did 13 Cats, he sat a lot, and then eventually after a while, he decided to stand up. But he'd sit in the back. But the first couple of shows, he'd sit down. And then he starts standing in the back. And like with Head Cat, you know, then Head Cat sit up. Like Head Cat, when we were four piece, he would stand in the back a little bit beside me. Lemmy, he'd stand a little bit behind Lemmy. I'd be beside him. We had the bass player back on the other side. But then he after we became a three piece, we set up just like the Stray Cats. So it was the Slim Jim, Lemmy, and me, like three of us in a line.
Right, right.
And but in the studio, he sit down.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I was just curious. Yeah.
I think it's mainly because we have to do so many takes, and it's
of course, man. And that's got to be hard on that.
Yeah, but having said that, Lemmy sits down when he plays bass in the studio, and I sit down when I play guitar in the studio. So
right.
It makes a lot more. So.
Gotcha. Yeah. No, let's be fair.
So he's allowed to sit down.
He's allowed. No, I got you, man. Well, listen, mate. You're playing tonight, or you're not?
No, I just came down to see a band. A friend of mine play the Elmore Reed band.
Yeah, a little Elmore Reed blues band.
Yeah. And I haven't seen him for a while, but Mark Hayes, the drummer, he's played. We used to do a lot of shows together, and so I haven't seen him for a while, like especially since like well before COVID. And then after him is Mrs. Jordan, and that's, I'm sorry, it's Mrs. Glass, but it's Jordan is the singer, and Jordan's a good friend of mine.
Right.
So I was coming down here, I was supposed to come down and see them, so.
You're here to support, which is, yeah, it's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool, we get to hang.
You're right.
Danny B. Harvey. Thank you, man. I really
hope this isn't the most boring podcast you've had.
Are you fucking kidding? This is good stuff.
I hope I didn't drop names, but you asked me who I played with, so
that's what this is all about. In a way, if you think about it, it does kind of end up that way. So you have to kind of name drop.
Yeah.
Thank you for doing this, man. I appreciate you taking the time.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me. That's fun.